I guess our own personal ambition is beyond the confines of the way it's been sold to us or told to us, been positioned as how it should be. Particularly for women, I think the conversation around ambition is so often framed as a trade-off between your public life and your private life, between your personal and your professional. And I even see, even in like very progressive circles, this implicit assumption that to succeed in one domain is to give up another. But that's only positioned that way for women. This is not positioned this way for men.
This is the Brown Way to Money podcast, where women of color in business find their financial independence path. Where do you think is that key element for women to pay attention now in the next decade to build wealth?
I think the most important thing we need to do is contextualize our own experiences within the experiences of all women or all women of color or the other larger contextual groups that we are all respectively part of. Because what I see happening right now is that we have all been so conditioned to internalize what happens to us as a personal failing. And that is because we have been brought up on these messages that our biggest barriers to opportunity are ourselves, our willingness to ask for more or even save or invest. But what we have learned over the course of certainly the last decade, but a much broader history, is that the forces that are happening beyond us are much, much greater than what we can. They have much more influence than what we do as individuals. Now, this is not to say that there's nothing we can do on an individual basis to improve our prospects and certainly to build wealth, but it is to acknowledge the influence and how big that influence is of these external factors, and to, again, contextualize what is happening to us within this broader cultural, political, institutional framework so that we're not turning inward, self-blaming, and then disengaging because we feel shame or because we feel like we're just not up to the challenge or we think that it says something about who we are or what we're capable of in terms of what we can build or sustain. But rather, we connect with other people who are going through similar experiences to understand that this is something that we are experiencing collectively as women. And that collective experience is something we can also leverage in fighting back. Because when we are not isolated and turning inward with self-blame, we can reach out to other people who are sharing our experiences. We can find the support we need. We can find tools. We can find resources. And we can come together to take action against some of these things that feel beyond our control, whether that's policies that are being passed, maybe not on a federal level, but certainly, you know, on the most micro level, like within our own workplaces, within our own communities, within our own localities, towns, cities, right? When I say that I'm talking about these bigger systemic ideas, these bigger systemic influences, and how much we have underestimated their impact, people often think, well, you know, if it's just the system, what can I really do about it? But a system is operating at so many levels. You know, it's operating at the scale of an interpersonal relationship between bosses and mentors and husbands and wives and friends, partners. It's happening at that scale. It's happening at an institutional scale, which is like a workplace or school or community. And it's then happening at the larger political and cultural level. So just because you're not operating at like the highest macro scale doesn't mean there's nothing you can do at these other levels. And I think the process of affecting change at the bigger levels really requires us reconnecting to that broader shared experience at these smaller levels, at the interpersonal levels, at building our communities, and realizing that what it's going to take to build our wealth isn't just about what we're doing individually, but how we're working together in community to push back against these bigger forces.
I like to double down on that, what you just said, that the system tends to make wealth building and financial problems an individual problem that is sprinkle with shame and guilt if you don't know better. What have you found on all of the research that you have done and through your own book that has been the biggest systematic narrative that affects the most at an individual level for women?
I just want to make sure I really understand what you're asking. Is the question, what is like the biggest systemic thing that is impeding our ability to grow wealth?
The narratives. So things like the biggest myth of women are not good with money.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that narrative beyond this, the systematic things that we know we have. Right. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I would say that so much of what enables these kinds of wealth inequalities to continue reproducing themselves really relies on a lot of myth making. So myths, like you said, this idea that women aren't just good with money, that's just one of them. I couldn't say what the biggest myth is in all of this, but I think it's a general theme that women aren't confident, women don't invest, women don't care about wealth, women aren't interested in pursuing high-paying careers. You know, I could go on and on and on. But all of this is a level of myth-making that is not actually grounded in data. The data does, and this is something I dig into in detail in my book, it's a lot of going through each of these arguments and showing people actually that's not true. But more than that, to your point, is what do these myths enable? And there's a really great study that looks specifically at the myth that women don't negotiate their salaries as much as their male peers. Now, this is very commonly assumed, even though it has not been true in the United States for just about two decades. Women have been more likely to negotiate their salaries than their male peers for about two decades at this point. And yet, the myth that women don't ask is still chronically used to justify gender pay inequity. Women just aren't paid as much because they don't ask for more. So not only is that not true, but the researchers found that people who believe that myth are also more likely to blame women for their own underpayment, and they are less likely to support policies and legislation that are proven to reduce gender pay gaps, like pay transparency initiatives. So I think that research really, really speaks to the power and the harm of these myths. Because what happens when you buy into this idea that women's greatest barrier to wealth building, to economic opportunity, not just women, everyone who's marginalized, when you buy into this myth that the inability to build wealth is an individual problem and an individual problem alone, you become more likely to double down on the policies that ensure those outcomes reproduce themselves. Because if you don't have a commitment to pay equity, if you don't have a commitment to transparency and true performance-based rewards and not ideas of performance-based rewards, then you will continue to reproduce the same inequality as we've experienced, even as other more explicit bans or restrictions fall away. And again, this is something I really document in detail in my book. I know I'm going on and on and on, but I want to give a quick example of this. There's a really great paper where they were hiring for the role of a police chief, and there were applicants, and the study participants had to decide, okay, who was going to get hired for this role of police chief? And they would compare a male applicant and a female applicant. And what would happen is if the applicant had a college degree and they were a man, then the study participants would say, well, we really should hire this guy, not because he's a man, but because he has a college degree, so he's more qualified. But when it was reversed and it was the woman who had the college degree, what the study participants did would say, well, we should hire the guy, even though he has less education, because college education really isn't really relevant for this job. And so we need someone who has like the street smarts. And so this is a really good example of the way inequality reproduces itself while kind of masquerading as a meritocracy, and how you can continue to generate the same unequal outcomes, even as you don't have people admitting to the fact that they're discriminating, but they clearly are.
What do you think are some of those three steps that women should be not only paying attention, but actually kind of like aiming to do towards reclaiming that agency with money. Because when I talk about financial trauma, the first thing that comes up is like avoidance. Well, I don't look at my bank account, or, well, to your point of women don't ask enough for salary negotiations. So like, why would I go to my boss so that they can reject me? Or, you know, we have this thing as an entrepreneur is that women tend to go after the next certification so that they can justify that they want to increase their prices, right? What do you think are three things that for the next decade, women should be paying attention more instead of leaning into the reasons why not to do it, so that we can kind of like flip that script? And even though that we are experiencing financial trauma, and even though that we know we are against a system that would take time to change, we still can reclaim that agency with money.
So I'll just say disclaimer, I'm not a therapist.
Yes.
But what I will say from but the conclusions that I really came to in this book in terms of like what we're getting wrong about what empowerment looks like is, again, coming back to this idea of this idea that it's an internal and individual process, as opposed to what I think it requires, which is for women to actually flip the script. And instead of thinking about like everything that they're experiencing as the outcome of something that's happening from within them, to flip the script and say, okay, how is this outcome being reproduced because of the environment around me? And instead of just looking inwards, what do I need to change in the environments around me? Or what can I change in the environments around me so that I'm not continuing to experience this same reinforcement of my financial trauma, or that I'm not exposed to people who are going to reinforce these myths or who are going to act on them. So I break this down in the book again by...
If you are enjoying this podcast, go ahead and subscribe and share. Only you can help us grow.
So I break this down in the book again by the interpersonal environment, friends, family, partners, the institutional environment, workplaces, communities, education systems, and then the broader political and cultural environment. And thinking about operating at all of those different levels so that, again, even if you're not rewriting the laws of the place you live, you're still feeling a sense of agency and purpose in curating those environments around you, even if it's happening just at the interpersonal level. And I think that's a really powerful way we can reframe what empowerment means. It's like, it's not something that's only going to come in relationship to myself. Power is by definition in relationship to the world around you. And your biggest impediments to it, particularly for those who've been marginalized, is typically not something that they are personally doing. It is that they are doing the same things as their more privileged peers, only to get a different response. And so that's not a problem of inputs. That's a problem of a system creating different outputs. So how do we change that environment? The second thing is, again, you can't do this alone, not just from a perspective of the actual actions you take, but the support system that you need in order to be able to take what individual action you are taking, right? And so one of the things I talk about is that we've kind of been like sold this idea that there's two models of womanhood in modern day. There's this idea of like hyper independence, where I have to do absolutely everything myself and I can't rely on anybody, or hyper dependence. And I think we see this example in really exemplified on social media today with the trends like the trad wife, where it's like, I don't want to do everything myself, so I'm going to give over all of my agency and just let someone else take care of me. And both of those models, I would actually argue, are incredibly risky, because there is no diversification whatsoever. If you are entirely reliant on yourself, that is too much to bear. And if you are entirely reliant on someone else, that's too much risk to take. And so what I want us to think about is, how do we create more interdependence? How do we diversify our sources of not just income, but of meaning, of support, of relationships, friendships, community? Thinking beyond just a relationship to a job or a relationship to a spouse, and thinking about all of the value and meaning and support we get in the world that extends beyond any single resource like a paycheck, but extends beyond like, who can I call on if I lose my job tomorrow and I don't have income and I can't afford anything? Do I have a network that I have built and fostered that, you know, I could go stay with them? Or do I have someone to call to watch my children if I'm in a pinch? You know, if you have not done that work, you will not be able to sustain a wealth building journey in this environment, because it is, we do not have enough of a meaningful economics and social safety net, at least in the United States, to be without having community resources and support as well. So I think everyone should really focus a lot more on interdependence and not trying to be either hyper independent or hyper dependent. So that's the second thing. My third thing in terms of like dealing with this trauma and how we move forward, I think it's to build a vision of what we think wealth and I guess our own personal ambition is beyond the confines of the way it's been sold to us or told to us or been positioned as how it should be. Particularly for women, I think the conversation around ambition is so often framed as a trade-off between your public life and your private life, between your personal and your professional. And I even see, even in like very progressive circles, this implicit assumption that to succeed in one domain is to give up another. But uh-huh. That's only positioned that way for women. This is not positioned this way for men. You know, family life and professional life, those two things go hand in hand for men. And this is really interesting because it happens across income levels. It happens across all forms of identity. But it's really the gender line where these things are positioned as a trade-off and mutually exclusive for women while they're mutually reinforcing for men. And so I really think moving toward the next step is about rejecting that binary framework of trade-offs for those who identify as women and really thinking more expansively, understanding that ambition is not something that has to be categorized into private versus public, and that it can and should be something that is mutually reinforcing. And the reason that it's not isn't typically because of something we're doing wrong, but because we're not given the same supports as our male peers. And instead of like warring with one another over which version of these trade-offs are the right ones to make, I want us to say, why are we being asked to make these trade-offs that our peers are not asked to, and to demand more, to demand a more expansive vision of what our ambitions are allowed to be?
I think to that point, and it's one of the things that I touch the most, is ambition being this bad thing to have, especially as a Latinos and as a Black woman. If you are ambitious, that is something wrong with you. Mm-hmm. But it's this weird concept, because you should be, or that's the way that we grew up, you should be ambitious enough to get ahead of maybe your family or your circle, but don't be too ambitious because that brings bad things to you. So I love that that's the last point, because it connects perfectly to the way that I see financial independence. You cannot have financial independence if you continue depending on the meanings and kind of like words that others have put into your definition of success and independence and ambition as well. With that point, how do you envision women building wealth in 10 years from now?
When I think about the future that I hope for my daughter, for all our daughters, for everyone, honestly, across gender identity, it's one that's really expansive. It's one where we're not operating from a chronic framework of what do I have to give up to gain some level of stability or rest or fulfillment. It's one in which our basic humanity is always guaranteed. And the support system needed for that is always in place. And that is not something that we have to struggle for. And that requires wealth building tactics that are not just grounded in what we personally save. It's in what we advocate for in our communities and what we demand from, you know, our politicians, certainly from our peers, and the kinds of resources that they offer us and we offer them, and how we show up for one another to ensure that every single person has a basic standard of care and life that they are entitled to because they are a human being. And that standard doesn't change across identity. That standard is guaranteed no matter who you are. And then from there, man, can you go after your ambitions in a real meaningful way if you are not chronically operating from a place of fearing the loss of everything. Because our imaginations and our abilities to realize things are so limited by that, all of us. And I think that's really a very, very sad thing. So what I want to see is a future where we are not constrained individually or collectively by that reality.
Okay. Did you hear something that you liked in today's episode? If so, don't keep it to yourself. Go ahead right now. Yes, right now. Before this episode ends, and send this episode to those three friends, three girlfriends that you know you can go to talk about finance, independence, money, business, growth, entrepreneur life, and all of these juicy topics. Share this episode with them because that is the only way we can grow together. I'm Alejandra Rojas, your host, and I will see you next week.